Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. The Alaska Sports Hall of Fame is in its 13th year honoring Alaska's sports community. This year's annual award ceremony will be held April 25th at the Anchorage Museum Atrium. This is a free event open to the public. In the first segment today, I'm going to talk to Harlow Robinson, who is a founding board member and current executive director of the Hall. We will talk about the history of the Hall as well as the class of 2019. In the second half, I'll be talking with two key figures in the history of the Alaska Run for Women. Terry Pauls, who is the founder of the Alaska Run for Women, and Kathy Wistoff, who is a founding board member and has been on the board since the beginning of the run 26 years ago. The Alaska Run for Women is entering the Hall this year in the event category. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We're going to start today's show with Harlow Robinson. He's the founding member and current executive director of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame, and that's going to be the theme of today's show, is the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And thank you very much for being here, Harlow.
Hey, it's great to be here with you, Lisa.
Yeah, you've been on Outdoor Explorer before, so you know the deal, how it all works. So that's pretty fun, too, to be a repeat guest, new guest to me. Can you please explain first how the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame came to be, how it works?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up, I'm a product of Alaska and sports. And, you know, I guess later in life as an adult, I not only have a lot of pride for, you know, some of our Alaskan athletes and some of the moments and events in our history that I feel like really kind of helped define our state's history and culture. But you also see the positive value in sports for young people growing up, and it certainly helped me to, you know, hopefully mostly be on a positive path in life. And, you know, as I got older, I was working with youth, and I did a lot of bringing role models in to talk with kids, not just athletes, but I could see it firsthand how impactful it was to have these people who are doing positive things motivate and inspire youth. So, you know, I think in looking at how the Hall of Fame was founded, part of it was wanting to preserve our sports history and celebrate it. And there was also another part of just wanting to create something that is a real positive resource for our, you know, our community, our statewide community. So Here we are, 13, we're coming up on our 13th annual ceremony.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Are there other states that have Sports Hall of Fame for their state? I'm assuming there are, but does every state have one?
There are, and I haven't checked in quite a while, but at the time where the idea, and it wasn't my idea originally, I think back in the 80s, Lou Friedman and whole staff at the Anchorage Daily News, which was a large staff at that time, created a kind of imaginary Alaska Sports Hall of Fame, and it kind of became this, you know, dog-eared copy that it definitely inspired me.
I think I remember that.
It was really cool. I mean, it was this kind of this who's who of Alaskan athletes and what have they done. And I thought, man, this is just a great way to kind of create a repository of information and all these amazing people. But Alaska was, I think at the time we were established about the 25th state to have a state Hall of Fame. So now there may be others, but those vary from beautiful brick and mortar facilities, museum style facilities. See a lot of those in the southern states where football and baseball are kind of, you know, entrenched in their culture, and they'd really like to celebrate that. To others where it's just maybe almost a virtual Hall of Fame with a website and not a whole lot more. So they really vary.
And we're kind of in between because you have the whole setup out at the airport, correct?
Yes. We have the actual hall at the Anchorage, Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. And that is great. We have all the enshrinement portraits up, although we are currently working with the airport on expansion because we've filled the walls.
I was gonna say, at some point you're going to run out of space.
Yeah, so we're growing, but it's great to have that actual gallery that the public can walk through, mm-hmm. and we get a lot of foot traffic through there. But, you know, so much of what we have is on our website right now. And we also have collected a ton of memorabilia over the years. Mm-hmm. And hopefully one of our kind of the board of directors and I are have a vision of a real facility with interactive exhibits, et cetera.
Oh, wow. That'd be really cool.
At some point down the line. So, you know, we try to get we have the actual physical facility, but then there's a lot that's online right now, and, mm-hmm. and that's really great stuff too. So every inductee has their own page, and you can go and see pictures and videos, and they all have a really great write-up and a video biography done by Channel 2 and mm-hmm. KTUU.
So how do the nominations work? I know I always get this email once a year. That's it's great. The voting is really easy online and everything, but how does it work to get people on there? Number one.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the harder things at the very beginning because we knew Alaska's crazy diverse, more so when you look at sports history, more diverse than really any other state in the union. I don't think it's even a debate. It's so geographically expansive.
Do you mean in terms of the types of sports
Sports.
Right. So
yes,
we have
types of sports. I mean, you know, you can go all the way back to the old Alaska Native games that really thousands of years of history and tradition there, and then the more turn of the century, you know, dog weight pulls and the of course dog mushing, and then the outdoor exploration,
like wilderness classics
and mountaineering, and then all our winter sports that we're so good at here in the state, and then on top of that all the mainstream sports. So it's, you know, trying to figure out how do we create a system where we can be equitable and evaluating someone's merits, you know, across all these different sports, and how can we make sure we're representative of this huge, expansive state. So anyways, I've tried to be really brief here. The one thing we did was put a panel of 9 people together, and which are, I think, you very much qualified experts in the realm of sports, and some of them are administrators, some are journalists, some are coaches, former athletes, and they cover just about every region of the state. Obviously, rural Alaska is extremely difficult, but they're a great knowledge base, and they come together every November or late November, early December, to place their own ballots. And each of those ballots, they precede that by a really robust debate.
Uh-huh.
So they may take on the subject of events as their first category, and they'll go around and they'll talk about all these events. But, you know, 13 years in, I can tell you that they all have the best interests of the state mm-hmm. in mind. And, you know, certainly they come with their own bias from their regions, et cetera, but they've always made the choice in what's in the best interest of our state. So we have those 9 panel members, and then there are 2 other ballots that are submitted. So if you think of it as 11 ballots total, the 10th ballot would be the public ballot. And that's what everyone sees online in the fall. And the public has the choice of choosing from a list of candidates on our website or writing in candidates. And the choices that are on the website are basically the top vote getters from the previous year that did not get actually inducted.
Okay.
So people ask that a lot, and that's how those names, those candidates end up on our website.
Okay, so if that person, the candidate, has never been ever before on the ballot, how do they get initially onto the ballot?
Onto the ballot. Yeah. One of 2 ways. Without getting too off into the weeds, if any member of the 9 panel, selection panel members, votes for somebody. So for people, they have 10 choices, mm-hmm. 10 slots, and they rank them. So the first place vote would get 10 points, all the way down to the 10th place gets 1 point. So any name that they put on that ballot will end up on the candidates page on our website.
Okay.
If they're not inducted.
Because the candidates page on the website, and that goes out in the email, that's for the people's choice, basically.
Yes, okay. That's the people's choice, and there's a good 50-plus people on there. Mm-hmm. And we get asked, how do you end up with that list? And that's how.
Yeah.
The other way is a concerted public campaign to get somebody on there has been very effective. And so if there's a write-in campaign and the person gets enough votes to move past other people on that candidate's list,
okay,
they get added. So
yeah, I love reading everybody's bio. I mean, I go through the whole thing, and it's just really fascinating.
What we realize is not everybody on that candidate's page is going to be inducted someday, but we love that the public has to go there and read these capsules on all these people. And at the very least, they're going to walk away more educated. Mm-hmm. And that's great.
And like you said, you really realize the diversity of sport in this state is really amazing. Reminder that this is Outdoor Explorer on KSK FM 91.1. And I'm your host, Lisa Keller. And I'm talking with Harlow Robinson today, the founding member and current executive director of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And your induction ceremony is going to be April 25th from 7 to 9 at the Anchorage Museum Atrium. So you're getting ready for that. And we're going to talk now about the individual inductees. And the first one that you are inducting this year is Corey Cogdell. Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, I think a lot of people know about her. She's a 2-time Olympic bronze medalist in trap shooting. But can you tell us a little bit more about her and her life in the outdoors in Alaska?
Sure. Yeah, I'm excited too. And we were talking about the diversity in Alaska. She's our first shooter. And, that's certainly a very Alaskan sport.
Yep.
And obviously, our hunting traditions around hunting are, rich. So it's cool that that sport is represented. We've done spectacularly well on the national and international stage in that sport. And Corey's really at the top.
Yeah.
I mean, she's had incredible success. She's one of the only Alaskans to medal twice in the Olympics. If not, I'd have to double check that, but she may be the only Alaskan with two Olympic. I'm thinking through this now as
I
speak.
Me too.
Tommy Moe has two, I know.
The skiers.
But she's highly decorated. And she actually grew up as a child. She lived in Chicoloon, Alaska, and was a country kid who came from a hunting family, learned to shoot at a very young age, and later moved to Eagle River and grew up there. And, she's become a real celebrity. I mean, she's kind of, if you follow shooting at all, she's on the posters. She's, definitely one of the Team USA's bright stars in the sport, and currently lives in Chicago. She married a former NFL football player. I don't think he's still playing. I have to check on that as well. And this is public knowledge now, but she's having a baby, due to have a baby about 2 days before the ceremony.
Oh.
So she is really bummed about the timing of it all,
because
she was incredibly excited to hear about the induction and the nomination, and wishes she could be here in person. She's going to be well represented and have a video to provide for the ceremony.
And is her family still here in Eagle River?
Some of her family and friends, coaches, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be good. And then the second individual inductee is Chad Bentz of Juneau, and he's a former Major League Baseball player, and he's got some interesting story behind his journey into the major leagues.
Yes, and we do have a baseball manager in the Hall of Fame in Red Boucher, but we do not have a baseball player. So both of these guys are kind of groundbreaking. And Chad, he has, let me first say, his selection is merited just based on his ability. I mean, he's one of three Alaskans to make the majors. He's the only Alaskan to ever record a base hit in a baseball game. And what's amazing is that he did this with a disability. He has one hand. He was born with only one functioning hand. And he, more than overcame adversity. Mm-hmm. He was a standout athlete in high school, multi-sport star, and just, you know, if you can imagine pitching, he was a major league pitcher. And
that's just amazing to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, no.
He would have to, like, switch his glove and the ball.
Yes, so he'd pitch, and he would tuck his mitt under his other arm when he pitched, and then in one fluid motion swing his hand into his mitt in order to be able to field in time for it. You can imagine a major league, you know, slugger getting a hold of one of his pitches, that it would take exceptional skill to be able to pull that off.
Yeah.
And then, of course, once you do field the ball, it's a matter of transitioning the ball back into your hand to be able to throw it again. So there was another major leaguer, Jim Abbott, who was about a decade before him with the same exact condition. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for Jim Abbott, I believe Chad would have been more of a nationally known name. But interestingly, Chad says that if it weren't for Jim Abbott, he may not have had the belief in himself that he could, like, he could do this. So,
yeah. Isn't that
really
great? Just one person breaking down that barrier.
Right. Broke down the barrier. And just an amazing story. And then to top it all off, he finished his major league career when he was about 30, and he went back and got his college education and decided, oh, what the heck, I was a pretty good high school football player. And so he played college football, Division III college, and he was a fullback. He scored a number of touchdowns, and does incredible sports career. Now he's an administrator, athletic director at Juneau mm-hmm. Douglas High School.
Well, that speaks really to the, you know, multiple sport athlete and how important that is, and what a great foundation that is for a lot of things. So that's amazing. So is he going to be here for the ceremony?
Yes, he will be here.
Great.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to meeting him. and that brings us to the event inductee, which is the Alaska Run for Women. And I do have to do some disclosure here, is that I was one of the founding members of the board of directors of Alaska Run for Women, and I was in there from the beginning. We are going to cover that more in depth in our second segment of this show. But if you want to give a really brief rundown on the Alaska Run for Women and how it got to this point.
Sure. You know, I just think running is a huge sport in Alaska, period. Mountain running is huge, but also you know, we're just active people, and there's several really standout kind of running and even extending into events like triathlon. But the Alaska Run for Women is the first one that is a kind of a community road run type of event selected for induction as an event. And I think what made it really stand out is the energy around it. It's just an incredible, I know you're going to talk about this more later, mm-hmm. but the empowering the empowering nature of it, and all the women coming together for a cause, really made it stand out. So, and it's a huge, huge deal now. So
I would agree with that.
Yeah, no, and it's
no
great.
Argument for me on that one.
And it's awesome to see the reception. I mean, there's so many people really excited about the selection. That's when we know we did a good job, when we see the positive feedback in the community.
Yeah, great. Okay, so the next inductee is the Moment inductee, and this is Kodiak's upset of perennial powerhouse East Anchorage, my alma mater, in the 2001 high school state title game. What I neglected to say was that is basketball. So tell us a little bit about
that.
Sure.
Yeah, this is kind of a classic David Goliath type of story, a Hoosiers, if you will. Story where Kodiak, you know, as you said, East High School, perennial power, Chuck White, the coach, this was his first year after he had left East. But what we're talking about is a championship game at the Sullivan Arena, where East High School had a team of future, you know, Division I level athletes, tall, athletic, a powerhouse.
A history of being the best at basketball.
Of being, you know, I don't even know how many state championships, but probably in the 20s. And
yeah. I know when I was there in the late 70s, early 80s, basketball was a big deal at East High.
Yes. I mean, East High is definitely, you know, if we're talking a national level, it would be the Lakers or the Celtics type, you know. And so Kodiak, there were a couple really cool kind of storylines going on. One is that they had a first-year coach who was a woman, and she has an amazing basketball resume, but, you know, she had to kind of break through some barriers to garner the respect of, you know, people along the way, probably first and foremost her team and her community. And she's an incredible coach, Amy Rakers, and she rallied a group of kids where four of the starting five were 5 foot 10 and shorter, including their point guard, Jeffrey Agmata, who was 5 foot 3.
Oh, wow.
And just an incredibly quick little point guard. And their fifth player was Nick Billings, who was 7 feet tall. And he was an exceptional shot blocking athletic center. So they had this really unique team where they had four hyper-athletic, short guys, and then a tall seven-footer, and just very contrasting style to the East High team. And Sullivan Arena that night was basically everyone that lived on Kodiak was there, and it was electric. The atmosphere was incredible, and Kodiak came from behind to end up winning the game. So just a... You know, basketball is such a big sport in Alaska, and this was one of those most iconic moments in our basketball history.
And going into the game, Kodiak was considered the underdog. Like, there was like, oh, yes. East is going to, you know.
Kodiak, although they had an undefeated season, they were clearly the underdog. And they were, you know. I think maybe they were given a small chance of winning, but you know, most people consider the Cook Inlet Conference and the Anchorage schools and the Rail Belt schools to be the powerhouses, and so you know it was an underdog story for sure, but you know, all credit to Kodiak, it was a very, very good team, and. You know,
and perhaps was there a little bit of cockiness on East High's part, like they thought they had it?
Yeah, I don't want to speculate, right. But I would guess that going in they were confident. So it's great. These are, you know, with our ceremonies, the moments have kind of unexpectedly become one of the real highlights, because a lot of times what we see is it's celebrating. A time, a real defining time in our history that might have kind of been forgotten for a while. And in this case, the community is very excited, and we keep getting emails and RSVPs, and the whole team is using
great.
It as a reunion, including the coaches and the assistant coaches and the traveling secretary and the manager. And
so
they're going to get together for the first time as a team since that game in 2001.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
That's going to be really great. Reminder that this is Outdoor Explorer on KSKA FM 91.1, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller. I'm talking with Harlow Robinson, the founding member and current executive director of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And the final piece that we're going to talk about today are the Director's Awards. So there's three different Director's Awards. There's Pride of Alaska, which has an adult and a youth nominee and inductee, and the Joe Floyd Award and the Trajan Langdon Award, who's also an East High graduate. And there's also an adult and youth segment of that. So how do those nominations work? And I know you haven't nailed down the selections yet.
Right.
But any information you can give us?
Sure. Yeah. No, we look for the announcement very soon. Our board of directors is finalizing. We have a selection committee. So it's difficult because we get so many nominations. So we kind of have a system of narrowing it down to a group of finalists, and we take it seriously. It's a really big deal now. It really is the bookend for our annual ceremony. At the end, we have the inductees, and the first half are the, you know, really what we're talking about with the Pride of Alaska are your athletes of the year. So, you know, for example, with the women this year, we have people like Allie Ostrander and Ruthie Hebert, the basketball player, and I could go on and on, but there's so many great athletes. This is a way to just kind of tie in some contemporary people that are doing great things with some people that have already had amazing careers that we're kind of looking back a little bit at.
And you do a men's and a women's award and a boy and a girl award.
Yeah, exactly. So men's, women's, Pride of Alaska, boys, girls, Pride of Alaska. And those are high school aged athletes. And then the Trajan Langdon Award, we have an adult and a youth winner. And that's really, Trajan Langdon was known for just being a person of integrity. And we want to value that in our athletes and celebrate people that have shown amazing, kind of outstanding leadership, sportsmanship, integrity in the world, in the realm of sports. So that award has actually been really fun to celebrate. And we've had amazing people come in to receive that. The Joe Floyd Award is about community contribution. So these are people that kind of under the radar, people that do great things for their community through sports.
Awesome. Sounds great. And so that we are recording earlier than this is going to be broadcast. So we're going to broadcast the week before the induction ceremony. So by then, we'll know who recipients of these.
By the time you hear this, you'll probably have seen the media release and and know who those people are.
Great.
Good point.
Yeah. Well, Harlow, it has been really awesome having you here. Thank you so much for coming in and explaining this. I really want to make this a yearly thing. So let's pencil it in for next year.
I would love that.
2020 will be the 14th annual, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you can come to the induction ceremony. It's free of charge, but you want an RSVP, I'm assuming.
No. Really, there's a VIP invitation, and those are for the tables, so those are reserved for, you know, people that are friends of inductees and honorees, et cetera. But beyond that, we have general seating, and people can just walk right in.
Great.
And, you know, we love to fill that place up, so there's room, and if all the seats are filled, there's always standing room.
Great. That'll be April 25th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Anchorage Museum Atrium. Thanks again, Harlow.
Thank you, Lisa, and we'll see you there.
Yes, I will be there. This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller. In the final segment of today's show, we're going to dive deep into the Alaska Run for Women. The event is being honored as an inductee into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame on April 25th. And with me in the studio are Terry Pauls, who is the founder of the Run for Women, and Kathy Wistoff, who is a founding and current board member. It's really great to have both of you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lisa.
Full disclosure before we go on, I have been involved with the Run for Women since Terry asked me to compete in the inaugural race in 1993, and I am a founding board member and a current race committee member. So we're going to start with the history, which is really fascinating and I think so appropriate for Alaska that this race started this way. And so we'll start with you, Terry, because you were the founder and you really got this show on the road. So it started in 1993, and tell us what was going on back then.
Yeah, Mother's Day 1993, I was having brunch with my friend Dan Ellsworth, who has a long history, or at that time, of being a participant and race organizer of running and ski races. And there had been an article in the Sunday Morning Paper by Lou Friedman, who was upset that the Alaska Women's Run was raising their entry fee. I think it was from $16 to $20, but it was more than the amount of money. He told me all about the history of different questions or suggestions that the women had had that the all-male board had not only refused, but was rather snide and rude. And he described to me, because I was a newcomer to Alaska at the time, that the whole community was kind of upset and the women weren't very happy with this run. And he ended up saying, because it sounded like it was kind of at a boiling point, he said, we should just put on our own run. And he said, Brooks Wade and I could put on an accurate course with accurate timing, but you'd have to do all the rest because you're the woman.
You have to be the face of it.
Right. And the whole history you can link to on the website. If you got me going on the history, you know, it's quite long. But what you'll mainly notice on the story on the website is how many people were involved. So many people stepped up to the plate, especially the Anchorage Running Club, the Nordic Ski Association, offering all their equipment. So many people wanted to help with this that it was a real confirmation. But of course, it wasn't me deciding to put the run on at all. I want to know, and I asked Dan, who are the top 10 women runners in the state? I didn't have the background to know what the real history was. So I called up all those people, including yourself, and they didn't say, oh, yeah, let's go ahead and do another run. They said, we'd like to talk to the race director of the Run for Women and share some of our concerns and see if he's willing to maybe, you know.
The race director for the women's run.
The women's run, sorry.
Yeah, this can get confusing because they're very closely named.
Yeah, and so then I called that race director and passed on the request to just sit down and talk with him. Not me, but you guys. And he was not interested and felt that it was fine that he was earning a profit and there was no beneficiary at all for the run. And so I said, well, you leave me no other choice then to go ahead with this. And I called the top women runners back and they all were completely on board, supportive with going forward with the run.
Yeah, that was a really exciting time. And I remember being very angry about what was going on.
Yeah.
And so the talk about race day, what happened race day, because that's pretty phenomenal. You kind of got the ball rolling. There was an ad in the paper with the names of all the top women who were going to be there running. And there were some women who chose to sit out the controversy, and there were some women who chose to run the women's run. So there were now two runs that were happening on the same day.
Right, exactly. And so I had TV cameras in my face before that because the media saw it as a big, conflict, whereas we were presenting it as an alternative to those who didn't want to pay the extra fee. There was no discount for little kids or grandmothers at all, or who couldn't afford it. It was $60 if you had three generations, and in that year, that was a lot of money. So not many people had signed up, but that article revealing all of the financials of the women's run and how it wasn't really truly a nonprofit came out the night before our run. Natalie Phillips had it on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News. And so race morning dawned, clear blue sky, and we had 500 women show up on race day.
To sign up, who were not previously signed up or hadn't picked up their bibs.
We had to delay our start by 15 minutes. It's amazing that we could, you know, handle that all in 15 minutes. But we ended up with 758 women that first year.
And do you remember what the women's run had that year? I think they originally had around 1,500 signed up.
They had gotten up to 3,000, but I think they were down to about 1,600, almost in half that year. And we started very close by because our first course started at Westchester Lagoon and was an out and back. And they were just up at West High.
So out women, and back to Point Warnsoff.
As far as it took to get the distance
almost,
we had. I think it was a 10K that year.
It was a 10K.
Yeah. And so they did the turnaround point so it would be a 10K. So.
Right. It was right at Earthquake Park. I remember now. It was at Earthquake Park.
So some women came down with their women's run T-shirts inside out from West High down to Westchester.
That's good.
To run in the Run for Women. And then Kathy was there selling the tank tops and ran out because so many people wanted the tank top.
Yep. And we took orders that day for additional shirts. And I think we probably sold several hundred more than what you had originally ordered because we had... You had 200 people pre-registered, and we ended up with 758.
Yeah.
So a lot of people wanted those inaugural shirts.
And it was Terry who asked you to come over and help with the merchandise? Or well, how did you get involved?
I got involved because at the time I was one of the women-owned businesses that signed on as a sponsor. I owned the Alaska Athletic Club, so I was a sponsor and told Terry that I would volunteer that day. Mm-hmm. And so when I got there, we were just, you know, she was assigning people to jobs, and I said, "Oh, I'll work the T-shirt booth," and she said, "Oh, that'd be great." And then I ended up staying after and taking orders from people. And
now you've been doing merchandise for 27 years.
I have been doing merchandise since 1993. Yes.
That was kind of a point of this race, too, was that I remember the T-shirt design had not changed for several years. And they had, like, for the women's run.
Of the women's run, yes.
And so we were going up to, like, a $25 entry fee without a change in the T-shirt design. And I think that is something that it's because of you, Kathy, that we have, like, a new design every year.
Every year.
It's an artist. It's a woman artist in Alaska who's doing this design. And that's another thing that's made it really special.
Right. And then we offer a whole variety, too. It's not just one shirt.
Yes.
And because we don't charge an entry fee, a T-shirt doesn't come with your entry. Right. That's a whole separate fundraising avenue for us. Mm-hmm. And so we set up a merchandise booth and we sell, you know, T-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, all kinds of great
and that's
things
been
with
a new
logo every year.
That's been such a great flow for for the programs for the Run for Women.
Yeah, and I think the women's run that year had cut not only age group prizes, but overall prizes.
Yes. Yes.
And so the question was, what does your money go to? It was, they had gone from long sleeve to short sleeve shirts, which didn't seem like that big of a deal, but it was just how everything added up.
A reminder that this is Outdoor Explorer on KSKA FM 91.1, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller. I'm talking with Terry Pauls and Kathy Wistoff about the Alaska Run for Women, which is going to be inducted as an event into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame on April 25th. And full disclosure, I've been involved with the Run for Women as a founding board member and a current race committee member. Okay, so we've had the race. It was a great success. And now it's like, what's the next step? So...
Well, I did want to point out that it was Roland Gower who, you know, during this time that the race was being developed, wrote a letter to the editor and suggested that fighting breast cancer be a beneficiary of whatever run or runs happened. Mm-hmm. And I read that and I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I think, you know, I'll choose to make that a beneficiary. And I decided against both American Cancer Society or National Cancer Institute because neither of them could guarantee that the money would be earmarked for research to really fight breast cancer, not just to diagnose or treat it. And I feel pretty strongly about this, that the Alaska Run for Women says on the website, the ultimate goal is to end breast cancer. And that's why I'm so thrilled that since 2009, they've one of the beneficiaries of the many and various beneficiaries, which is so great, but one of them is Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Mm-hmm. Which is actually helping to phase out and replace synthetic chemicals that are harmful to our health with safe alternatives. And that's not only breast cancer, but all kinds of cancer, as well as Parkinson's and a lot of other diseases. Mm-hmm. So I've been thrilled that they, you know, we now support them, and I'd like to even see more support for really looking into how we can phase out, because there are a lot of really healthy replacements for those synthetic chemicals that we're all swimming in every day.
And this kind of goes back to the money that was raised early on, Kathy, that we did have a big discussion about, is this just going to breast cancer? Is this money going to go outside to research?
Right.
And then that plays with the Susan G. Komen race and why we aren't part of that. And so you can probably speak
to that. When the board was formed, it was put into our bylaws that at least 70% of all the money raised would stay in Alaska and fund programs that benefit breast cancer. Up to 30% could be sent to a research foundation. And for the first 7 years, I think, that 30% went directly to Susan G. Komen. And we stopped giving them money in 1999 was the last year they got it. Because they stopped letting us earmark and dictate where we wanted that money spent and how. It just went into their general fund, and they wouldn't give us an accounting of where what it was being used for. So then we started looking for other places to put it. And so it's moved around a little bit, but the last several years it's gone to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, which is a very reputable, highly thought of organization outside. So every year we've been sending them maybe $30,000 to $40,000 for research.
Well, I have this memory, and we'll see if it's correct or not, if you can back it up. But I also have this memory that we would go down and make a presentation at the race in Dallas, and we would bring the biggest check of anybody, like $25,000 to $40,000.
That is correct, right. And they would make a big deal about it. And how, you know,
they did
happy
make a big
they
deal
were
about.
To
okay.
get the money. That's uh-huh. what I mean. Is like they, yeah. It was a big deal. And, uh-huh. and a big check was presented. Our Alaska runners that we sent down were presented, mm-hmm. and they're the ones who had the check and all.
And this was and Susan Komen.
This was for the Susan yes. G. Komen, yeah. right. And then that all just went away.
Yeah.
They stopped
even,
being
even earlier than
us.
That. They asked if we wanted to become a Race for the Cure, but
True.
We realized that every single decision would have to go through them. Well, mm-hmm. that's not very Alaskan,
right? Not Alaskan at all.
We wanted,
and
we,
they
course,
wanted more than the 30% yeah. that we were willing to give
yes,
them.
Yes,
if you were going to become a Race for the Cure, they got all the proceeds.
Yes,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember at the time, and again, I'm not sure if my memory is correct, that every state had a Susan G. Komen race except for us, like we opted out. But I looked last night, and there are several states that don't have Susan G. Komen mm-hmm. race anymore. But there are several states that have several of them.
Yes.
So that's
true.
It's still
very big.
Yeah, it's still, but mm-hmm. I think we did it the right way, the Alaskan way.
Yeah
it's
exactly.
our race.
Yeah, and we wanted the money to stay here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to date, since 1993, we've raised $4.6 million.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Most Stunning. Of which has stayed here and funded programs throughout the state. And mm-hmm. this is not an acreage race. You know,
right.
We try to reach out.
Well, that's the other thing. There are satellite runs around the state now.
Do we yes,
are there
yes,
still some
there
satellite
There are
runs?
A couple of runs, but they're not really part of us. Like, mm-hmm. we don't organize them.
Okay.
They organize on their own, but then they send us money.
Oh,
you know,
so yeah, because it goes
nice,
to Alaskans. So. The
yeah.
money goes to Alaskans.
Yeah.
So one of the big controversies early on, this hasn't been much of a controversy at all lately, is why no men in the race?
Yes.
And I know, I'll start this with, I remember when we set down our guiding principles, one was research and prevention and everything of breast cancer and women's health issues. That's where money would go. But the other, it was a two-piece mission. Mm-hmm. The other piece was to recognize the top women runners in the state. And we did have some pushback from some men early on mm-hmm. why they couldn't compete. So what's your memory of that? And, you know, how has that been resolved, or has it been resolved?
Well, in college, I remember I was a real competitive cross-country ski racer, but I did a women's run just for cross training in Minneapolis. And a big part, I think, the third prong of women is the sisterhood mm-hmm. thing, which I think is interesting to look now at the Me Too and the Time's Up movement of, you know, I think that's increased even a sense of sisterhood. So that's one piece of it that's really valuable. But for myself, when I would start cross-country ski race, I was mass starting with men and women. And, of course, the majority racers were men. I'm talking about to date myself, the even late 70s and the 1980s. And I was in a sea of men. And I was 16 years old when I first won, you know, overall woman for the local ski race. And I didn't even know that I was the first woman in the sea of men until my brother, who was standing on the sidelines halfway through, told me. So I think you've had a similar experience,
yep,
Lisa,
absolutely.
In running races.
Yep.
And so I think women deserve to know where each other are. So with the women's run, of course, you've got only the women's competitors. And likewise, again, this guy, Dan Ellsworth, who suggested the run, I suggested that there be an elite women's wave in the 25-kilometer tour of Anchorage way back when. Well, he was a very key timing volunteer for PJ Hill at the time with the tour. And he passed that on to PJ, and PJ did start an elite women's wave mm-hmm. that was started immediately after the elite men's wave for the 25K. We were skating, and I got to be in a train for that entire race with my competitors, the top UAA women back then, at that time.
It is
a completely different experience. Yeah, so that you're not in a sea of men. It mm-hmm. is, you can see where you are with the other women, mm-hmm. and that's important too.
Yeah. Well, early right. on, you remember we did have some men who were attempting to run the race.
Right. And you know, it's not an issue that's gone away. Mm-hmm. We still
okay.
deal with it
yeah.
pretty much on an annual basis. The reasons for it have changed a little bit. The people that we get requests from now want to be out there to support a breast cancer mm-hmm. survivor or maybe a newly diagnosed family member, and they want to be able to participate with them. So the race is, in that respect, has evolved in a bit in two ways. One, we have allowed men with breast cancer to participate and actually have a bib. They're not timed because we're sticking with that, that only women runners are timed because we want to really showcase our women athletes. But we also have allowed men on the course as a support person or team with the a woman runner who is a breast cancer survivor, a newly diagnosed patient. So you will see a lot of men out on the course, but they should not be wearing bibs. And we ask them not to cross the finish line. And they've been pretty respectful of that, but it is something that comes up almost annually.
You know, I haven't seen a man cross the finish line in a long time, but it seems like maybe there's always that one outlier out there.
And I haven't seen it either. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but I haven't seen it, and I don't think our photographers have captured that. So
that's good. And what we really need to also emphasize is that the role that men play as volunteers in this race. I mean, and there's really just such a great group of men that come out and help put this race on. And we definitely need them if everybody wants to, if all the women want to run the race.
We do need them. And that's what, you know, our answer to them when they approach us and say, hey, why can't men do this? We say, there are so many ways you could participate in this run. And then we give them a list. You can volunteer here, there, you know, help us set it up, help us tear it down. You know, there's so many jobs that we need done on race day, especially. And we could use your muscle and you know. So we encourage them to still come out and participate, but in a different way.
A reminder that this is Outdoor Explorer on KSKA FM 91.1, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller. And I'm talking with Terry Pauls and Kathy Wistoff from the Alaska Run for Women, which will be inducted as an event into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame on April 25th. In full disclosure, I have been involved with the Run for Women as a founding board member and a current race committee member. So over the years, there have been some course struggles because this has become such a big race. So what was the the highest year? Do you remember?
Yes.
8,000 or 9,000?
In 2011, our biggest registration was 7,200 people. Okay. That's the biggest.
Yeah.
And that also coincides with the year that we added a party wave.
Women love the party
wave. Yeah, the party wave is just the 5 mile like everything else, but it starts at the end and it's for people that want to meander, you know, chat and, you know, be with friends or push their strollers. You know, that's where we ask the strollers to be so that there's, you know, nobody getting run over. And it added a whole new dimension to the race. And it went up a couple of thousand that year just because of the party wave. We've come back down from that high, but we seem to settle right around 6,000 now. So it's still it's the biggest race in Alaska.
And
one of the largest all women's runs in the country.
Oh, is it really?
Yes.
Well, I think if you compared our population in Alaska to that number and then like compared it to LA, it would require like, 20 or 30,000 women to come out in LA to be comparable. So, So the race is kind of half on city streets and halfway on the bike trail. And it starts down by Mulcahy Stadium on 16th.
Correct.
And there have been years where we've struggled because there's been construction, and we have tried to move it previously all onto city streets, but that's been a little bit
struggle. A combination of the municipality not wanting to allow it and just not willing to permit it. And then also in asking our participants what they want. There's been a real pushback from people saying, don't take the coastal trail away from us.
Oh, that's interesting.
They love the view. They love that part of the race, and they don't want to do an all city street race.
Okay.
Yeah, and every time we've done a poll, that's what the feedback we get.
I guess that's true. Like, maybe I'm a little bit jaded having, you know, run these trails for all my life, basically, but it is a really fantastic view and
a
special course.
And the only reason that we've even contemplated changing many times over the years because it's gotten so crowded. And when we first get to the beginning of the coastal trail, there's a real bottleneck there, especially at the end where the majority of the people are. The front runners have no problem. They don't get held up anywhere. They just shoot right through the, you know, the whole course, no problem. But there's a bottleneck there, and especially when you're talking about groups of people that want to walk side by side or are pushing strollers. So we've been concerned about that from a safety issue of wanting to move it somewhere else. But people are willing to put up with that crowdedness and to keep the coastal trail as part of the course.
Yeah. And so there are three waves now, right? There's a timed wave that goes out first, and then there's a party, or then there's an untimed wave.
And then the party
and
wave.
And then the party wave.
And then the other thing we did, probably, I think it was in 1998, is when we added the 1 mile event.
Oh, right, the 1 mile.
That brought out new people, too, because there were people that would, they look at 5 miles like you're asking them to run a marathon. It's like they just couldn't do it. 1 mile brought out more kids. And some women that were like going through treatment and just did not have the energy and couldn't do 5 miles. So, we try to evolve and change things to accommodate more people and have more options. And I think that's really helped. And so the three waves, one of the reasons we did that was because the city police asked us to help control the crowds. Mm-hmm. And so if they go out in waves, there's a break in between each of them, and then they get to get all those people through the intersections, hold up cars for the entire time that, 5,000, 6,000 women are trying to get through intersections. So that allows them to keep traffic moving.
Mm-hmm. And the distances have changed because the first year, Terry, it was a 10K,
right?
Mm-hmm. And then we went to an 8K, which is 4.95 miles.
Yes.
It's almost a 5 mile.
Almost a 5 mile.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then it changed to just a straight five mile. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember the reason for that. Did it have something to do with the course?
I think it had to do with the course.
Yeah. Something changed
because
in there.
Because the 5 mile has been our event for so many years now. I mean, we are just known as the 5 mile run.
And it's great because it's kind of an unusual distance. It is. You don't usually run that.
Yes,
in most races.
That's been one of our poll questions too, when we've asked people, would you prefer if it was a 5K or longer or whatever? And people like the fact that you don't find a 5 mile very often, and it's kind of a good distance.
Yeah.
Whether you're a runner or not, five distance is doable.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, great. Okay, so. Why do you think that this race has just really resonated with the community, and why it was chosen as an event? I mean, you kind of skipped ahead of the Gold Nugget, which is the oldest all-women's triathlon in the world.
Right.
And for some reason, this has really resonated with the jury or the selectors of the induction and everything. And why do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think one reason is that you can always walk. Mm-hmm. With a triathlon, you need a bike, you need to be comfortable in the pool. It's a little more complicated, the transition zones and so on. And
it's more intimidating.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And then also I think the whole breast cancer, support, and which, I never would have anticipated that as an athlete like Lisa and like Keegan Randall would get breast cancer so young at age 49. And I think you were earlier, Lisa.
I was 38 and Keegan was 36.
Yes, even younger.
Six, I think.
Right. And what I found is having been so athletic and healthy that it just didn't. I was in a funk. Of course I am with all that I'm going through. But what the run did for me, and I was diagnosed on December 18th, and the run is in May or June, it really helped me shift my identity at a deep level from, now I'm back to feeling like a healthy, athletic woman.
Awesome.
But it helped me integrate the cancer survivor piece. Mm-hmm. And so I think, not only does that draw a lot of people who probably really appreciate the 1 mile during treatment and as a survivor, but like me, all of their women friends, either from work or in my situation, Raven's Roost co-housing, all of my neighbors to be in 2015, formed a team. Mm-hmm. And when you have a team of people, you don't always have people who are runners. And so I think just being able to walk it together as a team is maybe what helped really balloon the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you read story after story of all the helpers and all the women who get together to join the person who is going through cancer. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's what made it such a big event, that it really helps us go through that experience of being diagnosed and dealing with the treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think it's twofold. There are so many people out there that are running in honor of somebody that they so important for them to be out there, and they tell us these stories all the time. And then the survivors, like Terry's explanation was perfect, and it feels like so many people are touched by breast cancer.
Yeah.
Yes.
If not personally, themselves, but somebody they know, either in their family or just, a coworker, somebody that they're close to. And it's an easy thing to support and be a part of. And it really is just as you know, because you've been out there every year, such a glorious event.
Yeah.
It's so full of camaraderie, and the emotions run high, and they run the gamut. There are people out there who cry when they finish when they come across the finish line, and then people who are high-fiving and jumping and laughing and having such a great time. And I think the color pink makes people happy.
Yeah.
And our pictures really show that.
You both have, well, we all three of us have pink. I did not do this on purpose.
Team shirt on. Yes. I think, too, we need to give a shout out and thank you to Sue Fison. It was her idea that very first run. She brought all the materials for making the signs that would go on
the
people's
back tags.
Oh, the back tags.
And they're
either
in honor of someone who is surviving or in memoriam of someone who.
And
who
we continue to do that to this day.
Yep.
And almost everybody has one on their back.
It's great. You go out and you remember the people you lost, and you remember the people who are struggling now. And it is really a reflective day.
I always write Rachel Carson on mine because a lot of people know she's like the founder of the modern environmental movement, but she actually died of breast cancer and she never even mentioned it. So it's a little known fact.
Well, we talk about it now.
Yes.
I mean, that's the other thing is people didn't used to talk about breast cancer.
No, it was quiet.
We talk about it. Mm-hmm. So.
Another thing I'd just like to share, because I think that this quote from Jerry Litzenberger, one of the first runners, really kind of captures the whole spirit. The first run was really electric because no one knew it was going to happen. It felt like a risk to even be there. But I just love this quote. One of my most valued possessions is this card I brought that's a thank you from all the top women runners from the 1993 run. But Jerry Litzenberger, I think, really sums it up when she wrote, "Belief gives birth to reality. Thank you for believing. That was one of the greatest events of my life, right up there with childbirth. I cried most of the way." And she explained that the first run was out and back. So the women were seeing each other. As the top women started coming back, they saw the women going out. And I was just back at Westchester Lagoon at the start-finish area. But I heard people say it was so emotional to see all those signs on people's backs. Everyone was crying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. It was really great reminiscing with you and remembering all these things that had happened. And it's such a great event. Congratulations on being inducted into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame.
It's you know that. I mean, it's just such an honor. We were thrilled to hear this.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I'm looking forward to the event itself where we get inducted.
I am too.
Absolutely.
So thanks, Kathy. And thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Lisa.
That's it for today's show. Earlier, I talked with Harlow Robinson, a founding board member and current executive director of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. The class of 2019 will be enshrined at the hall's 13th annual ceremony and reception, being held on April 25th at the Anchorage Museum Atrium. The event is free and open to the public. The individuals being inducted are two-time Olympic bronze medal-winning trap shooter Corey Cogdill of Eagle River and former Major League Baseball player Chad Bentz of Juneau. In the moment category, Kodiak's upset a perennial powerhouse East Anchorage in the 2001 high school state basketball title game is getting the nod. In the second half of the show, I talked with Terry Pauls, the founder of the Alaska Run for Women, and Kathy Wistoff, a founding and current board member of the run. The Alaska Run for Women is being inducted in the event category. Thanks to my guests for the great conversations and exemplifying the mission of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame: teach, honor, inspire. Since we recorded this episode, the director's awards that were mentioned by Harlow have been announced. There are 7 total director's awards, but one in particular, the Trajan Langdon Award for Leadership, Sportsmanship, and Inspiration, is going to childhood friends of mine, Andy Beardsley and Larson Klingel. I'll be recording a show with them later this month to be broadcast in May. Their story is inspirational. You don't want to miss it. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.